This interview is being conducted on November the 17th, 2005 in Victoria, BC. The interviewer is Judith Gertson of the University of Victoria, and the interviewee is Rear Admiral Richard Lear. Admiral Lear, I wonder if you just briefly tell me when and where you were born and where you grew up.
I was born and raised in Penticton, BC. And despite my accent, everybody spoke like this up in New Okanagan in the 20s and 30s. I then was educated in Penticton up to grade 7. And went to Charlie Lake boarding school up until I finished school. That's why I joined the Navy, who wrote the Navy Canal. And that was a quick answer.
Yeah, and just what was the date of your birth?
Oh, 19th of November, 1921.
And how old were you when you enlisted then?
17. Just on 18.
And did you do your training in Canada?
No, in those days there was no training college in Canada. We were all sent to England to the training ship Frobisher. And then I was only in a short number of weeks when it was taken over for active service, and I was put ashore in Dartmouth.
What was the first ship that you served on?
Yeah. HMS Nelson. We were midshipmen. Went to big ships. And the Canadian Navy didn't have any. So we were always sent to big British ships to start your midshipmen's training. With the Australians and the Royal Navy. Dragged me off, and then they said the cruiser Exeter came in, and she was short a few midshipmen, and so they said, well, we're going to have to send you off in this one. So I went off, and we continued the war in and around Smith Hill, and then the International Cruiser Squadron was put together. We made up with the Dutch, the British, and the United States, and we fought in a battle called the Battle of the Java Sea. And Exeter was sunk in that battle. Gangway, you know, a wooden gangway, which was great because the sharks wouldn't get at you. There were five of us on there. And then a Japanese destroyer came by and stopped and started picking up a few survivors. And there was a debate on my group as to whether it was a good idea to go for the Japanese. I decided to go for it. Had been a competition swimmer in school, so I struck with them. And it seemed like they were naked. The rescue vessel got further and further away, but eventually I laid the side of this vessel and found out I was in the room off that raft. And I was taken aboard. I spent 2 weeks. Japanese Navy being shifted from one ship to another. There were about 40 of us. And they treated very well. And in fact, the first rescue vessel, the second command, English was almost perfect. It was trained by the RN, the same as I had been. And so it was that was quite good. And then about 2 weeks altogether of that life, I was deposited on a beach in the island which was then called the Salinas, now called Sulawesi, and along with the rest of the group, and where we had to on the western side, the eastern side of the island, which is rather like an H-shaped drop. And we had to build a camp. And that's when my personal war life started. I was 19. And of course, that age, you think you can do anything. So I found that I was handy with a double-edged axe and being raised in lumber camp. And Joe and I were more or less to my father and I used to go. And I was able to show all those English sailors how to wield the axe and the cross-cut sword. Well, we built ourselves a camp, and the Japanese thought that I was pretty smart, so they made me a gunkan, which is Japanese for leader, and you had a working party, and the whole time I was a prisoner, I was a gunkan with a special armband, and was required to direct some 50 men, all older than I was, and eventually I had a gang of Australians, which were quite a handful. And we stayed in that island for a year and a half. It was a pretty... Mostly we were building a pier for a nickel mine that was opened on that island, an open cut. And we had various jobs. being a goat can, I didn't have to actually pull the rope, pull the, do the pickaxe work and stuff like that. But it was hard work, very diseased. We had a very high rate, and for some reason, mosquitoes don't bite me. So I didn't get malaria or dengue fever or very peculiar diseases that nobody knew anything about in those days. We had no medical support. We used to call a sick bay tiffy, which is a medical assistant on the ship. We had a doctor. And the casualty rate was quite high. We lived in what we called, what we now call Nafap Shack, made of bamboo and palm fronds, making a roof. And endless outdoor life almost. And about a year and a half later, some bombers came in and bombed the mine. Barracks of the Yankees in our camp, and more or less closed the mine. In the meantime, we kept on applying, saying, here's my name and number. They looked at the list, the Japanese looked at the list of names and numbers, and then we never saw them again, but they didn't report us. As a result, I was discharged dead by the I was missing for 6 months, and then my mother received a Memorial Cross, which is and you see on the back, extract from the Navy list. Sideline. It's nothing to do with being a prisoner of war, but my mother sent it back in the Christmas of 45 when I got home. And 10 years went by. And they were moving the headquarters and hospital, and they found the cross and citation in the back of an old drawer. And they said, what do we do with this? And somebody said, well, why don't you send it to me? He said, serving down. And so this cross arrived in the mail, and it's a pretty rare business to look at your own death bill. As you can see, they say nice things about you when you're dead. So then we stopped handing our name and number in. There was no Red Cross, there was no contact with we had no Red Cross packages or anything like that. So the next job took place in southern Sumatra. We were put into a vessel which was half full of ore, which we had mined from the mine before it was destroyed. And we were shipped across very slow, hiding every night along the island because of the air. I was sick with Allied aircraft and Indonesia. And started to work on the very bottom of Sumatra in a fuel well. Refinery, and we were working in the refinery, which was set down with officers in the hollow. And there were great gasometers full of gasoline on it. course, we were marching. We were there about 3 months when one morning we woke up and the air was full of airplanes. Two aircraft carriers had come up and attacked the establishment, which exploded. The first time I'd ever seen rockets fired from aircraft into the big gasometers, which spilled their contents thousands of gallons of gasoline. It was horrible, and we roasted all the officers, which were full of Japanese, who thought it was great. Luckily, we had got there. We were still marching. We were spared. And that was the end of that job. I was then shipped to Java, first of all, up in the hills, growing behind the growing, uprooting tea and growing it's for making oil. You squeeze oil from it. That was a gardening job, which was quite pleasant. But then that came to an end. Oh, I know, they decided that they wanted us to build cars. And they had captured a lot of half-constructed North American cars, which were finished in a factory outside the capital city of Batavia. And they came to the camp up in Bandung, it's called, up in the mountains of Bandung, and said they wanted some bunch of mechanics. They said, well, you own cars, so you must know how to build them. So will you come, we're going to send you down. They said, do you know how to build a car? And I said, we all said no. And they said, well, you must, because you own them. So then they said, they shut the food off for a couple of days while we made up our minds. And we all decided to volunteer. There were about 300 of us. And we were put on the train and sent down to Batavia, now called Jakarta. And we worked in a assembly plant, putting together engines for cars. They had captured the frame of the car, and the engines were in packages, beautifully packed, and an instruction book, literally, of how to put an engine together. There was six-cylinder Detroit jobs. And so I became a mechanic. It was really quite significant. It took us about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, to put the first engine together. And then we found, to our surprise, that when we cranked it, it worked. And this went on for about a year, and then we were living in old barracks in the center, near the center of the city, and there was a huge parade ground next door called one morning we the loudhailers booming on this parade ground, and we scrambled up on the roof of our barracks with an interpreter. And here was the local general haranguing about 4,000 of his men who had been paraded there since dawn about how it was the war was over and they would all go home. So that's how we learned that the war was over. The senior officer in the camp was a very fine squadron leader. He put on the remains of his best uniform and went straight to the prison camp. Sword and the piece of the island of Java, which was where a one-man effect, one-man business. The locals were trying to beat up the Japanese and the remnants of the white men were there, and so we had a kind of private war. I armed myself with a Japanese Sten gun and ragged clothes. We helped defend the city of Batavia from the insurgents, which were, used to call them the Haihō Army, which we had the Japanese had built in order to protect the island against the invading allies. So this army went into nobody in charge, Japanese gave up. And so we sort of had a kind of private war for 3 weeks. I thought it was great fun. I think I weighed less than 100 pounds at the age of 22. I didn't think anything could hurt me at all. That was about the year. Story. Eventually a very large airplane, because I'd never seen landed, and it was an American aircraft that came to take away the survivors of the American cruiser Houston, which had been sunk with us, and they were loading up there, men, and they said, is there anybody else? And he said, well, there were two Canadians in the camp with me, and George Tidy from Toronto. And I stepped up and said, we're North Americans. And he said, well, get in, son. And so we flew direct from the island of Java to the city of Calcutta, where the 80-month battle had opened a prisoner of war reception center in the Viceroy's Winter Palace. And I was wearing my homemade pants and shirt and wooden clogs. And we stepped out of the airplane, and much to the amazement of everybody around, ordinary passengers, and they whisked us off to this absolute heaven where we were given every hair in our body was shaved, and two bits of cotton wool were held up to your nose, and you jumped in the swimming pool, which was full of sheep dip or something, and as I came to the surface, there was a huge mass of little creatures that I'd been carrying around for many years. And then we thought it was my first pair of had no ID, no papers of any sort. And so George Tardy and I were given the green light that you were fit to travel. And they gave me £50. And I went down and bought a uniform, decided I'd be a lieutenant. And Tidy, who was quite senior, who was a radar expert, decided to be a lieutenant commander and put on this uniform and went down to the mess. Now, this was a period when there were a lot of cargo planes, empty cargo planes, going back to Europe after unloading all sorts of cargo to work with at the end of the war. And so we had no trouble hitchhiking empty cargo planes across India and then down to Alexandria in Egypt, where somebody, I don't know who, took pity on us and put us on a proper flying boat, passenger boat, passenger flying boat. And we flew from there to England and landed in Japan and so on. And we went up to report to the Canadian headquarters in London, where they... I went to Deves first. Deves was a naval tailor, and had myself in a uniform. And they seemed to know all about me. I said, "Oh yes, Mr. Lear, you were here. And each time they said here, and they gave me a ribbon, medal ribbon, you know, campaign ribbon. And they put it on the uniform. So I walked out covered with ribbons. And a brand new suit, and went and reported to the Canadian authorities. Before I could say anything, they said, "Ah, that's the man we're looking for. We have a draft of 250 sailors up at Glasgow who require you, when we require you to take them over back to Halifax in the carrier, in the Canadian carrier Puncher." So I didn't, with that, I had a travel document, so I could go to the money king and get some cash, which I did, and we set back and traveled back to Canada that way. However, I was eating all along, saying, "Look like a scarecrow," and drinking too much, I expect. And it was November, by November 1945 by now, and we were entering harbor and lined up on the flight deck of this carrier, which is the naval practice, whereupon I fainted, passed out completely, woke up in the hospital in Halifax, probably a lucky thing, because some of the best doctors in the country were certainly the Canadian Navy, and all down in Halifax. And all the prisoners of war coming from Hong Kong were landing in Victoria, and the doctors were sort of felt like they were out of it. And, all these prisoners who had extraordinary diseases that many people hadn't even heard of, and they said, "Well, how fortunate we are. We've got a genuine malnourished prisoner of war to play with." And they all fell on me like vultures. And I'd been dreaming of steak, eggs, and chips for years. And they said, "Right, you can't have that anymore. You have to have baby food 7 times a day, because we're not letting you out of here until you weigh more than 150 pounds. And they did just that. I spent all of November and half of December in the hospital. While I was there, sat on my back, somebody said, "Well, have you tried telephoning home?" And they just finished building or installing the transcontinental telephone system some months before. I said, "No, did. It was 10/6/97. So I went to the phone, and I could hear the operators across the country. It took about 12 or 15 minutes to make the connection to 10/6. And then